Thanks everybody for coming. I would like to thank John for inviting me. And it's always a pleasure. Okay, well, whoever. Both. Anyway, it's always a pleasure to come back here and give a talk. I always had a very nice and heated discussion. Yeah, and hopefully today we'll have another one. So the topic of today's seminar is objectivity and the emergence of classicality, something that's been widely investigated in the quantum case. And now we want to do foundations even of that. So, and the way to do this is to go beyond the quantum case to see what we can say in that case. So first of all, I'd like to thank my co-authors, Roberto Salazar, Jarek Korbic, and Paweł Horodecki, for the idea and the general support for this work. So the interesting thing to note is that classical theory is objective in the sense that different observers agree on what they see. So for example, if we see this glass of water, we all agree on what we see. Instead, in quantum theory, this is not the case, because in general, due to the disturbance of measurements, then there is not generally an agreement. And recently we know about all the paradoxes that arise when people are describing the point of view of other observers. So this is, in general, kind of a thorny issue. And we want to see where the ultimate origin of the objective behavior lies. And to this end, for the quantum, in the past, there have been made various proposals. There's, for example, de Coherence, that was the earliest one. Then there's quantum Darwinism, which is some sort of upgrading of the notion of de Coherence. So if de Coherence is some sort of the selection of the fittest states using this Darwinist terminology, then the quantum Darwin is also the reproduction of those. So basically, the information is redundantly encoded in the environment. This is the way it's objective, because there are several copies, then several people can access it. So the idea beyond that is some sort of broadcasting of the information from a system to the environment. And then more recently, there was this approach based on spectrum broadcast states. And this is the one I will focus on. Don't worry if you don't know what they are, I will go into that. So it's some sort of a stronger version of quantum Darwinism. Recently there was a paper where they showed that actually if you impose a stronger notion than quantum Darwinism, then you get that objectivity is represented by those kind of states. So in other words, the fundamental question is what part of quantum theory is actually responsible for the what we see about classicality and objectivity in nature. And from this point of view, it's useful to look at quantum theory from the outside, by means of seeing it as some sort of privileged island in some sort of landscape or of more general scenarios. And this framework is called a generalized probabilistic theories. This is also useful because it can give us a new perspective also on extensions of quantum theory. Maybe in the future, if quantum theory is replaced by something else, then we know at least if there are any constraints. For example, everything should be able to account for the emergence of classicality and objective behavior. So therefore, if this search basically poses some constraints, then we know that the theory can't have some particular features. So, yes.
Can you say a little more what you mean by classicality? I think you explained objectivity, but I'm not sure.
Classical physics.
What you mean by, you mean with classical Hamiltonian motion and all of this?
Well, that's a, I mean.
How much of classical?
Exactly. That would be like maybe the final step. But so far we are just, I will tell you later what I specifically mean. In this case, it's a sort of static version of classicality, the existence of states that can be distinguished in a single shot. That's what I mean by that. It's a sort of information theoretic definition of it rather than a dynamic, really dynamical one. So in order to study this problem, we work in the framework of general probabilistic theories, specifically the one having diagrammatic approach that was developed by a group in Pavia and also by Luce and Hardy here. So the basic entity is what we call a test. A test is, let's say, the analog of the quantum instrument. So it's a collection of processes that can occur as mutually exclusive alternatives in an experiment I perform. So in an experiment, I will only observe one of those. So that's the outcome. I basically recall that actually this represents a classical data that's recorded by some sort of pointer device, whatever we want. So it's actually important to note that actually this quantity is, the outcome is something that's really classical. Then, of course, there are some experiments that are deterministic in the sense that basically we can immediately predict the outcome of the experiment whenever we perform it. And these experiments, these tests actually are called channels and they represent a deterministic evolution of a quantum system, of a generic system, like they also do for a quantum case. A state is a particular case of preparation. It's a particular test where essentially we don't have any input here. A and B are just input and output systems. Here I have no input, which I don't represent it as a with a wire. Therefore, this can be seen as some sort of the act of preparing a system in a particular initial condition, if you want. And then we have also the dual case, where we have some test that actually destroy the system. So after that, we only have the classical information encoded in the outcome, but there's no system left. So it's some sort of demolition measurement. In quantum theory, they would correspond to POVMs. Here we call them simply measurements, or alternatively also observation tests. And the important thing is that, just to agree on the terminology, the elements in this set are called effects. And there, instead, the CIs are called transformations, general processes, whatever. Good. So the good thing about this diagrammatic approach is that it's very nice to construct experiments, even thought experiments, by simply building circuits using the diagrammatic rules. So for example, in this case, we have a state rho I that it gets initialized for, basically initializes A and B as systems, and then I perform these other measurements in sequence. First, AJ and BM are composed, done in parallel, independently. Then I don't do anything on B prime. I do A prime on the other one, and eventually I measure both of them. Say that's an example. And I explicitly represented all the outcomes here, like with the subscripts. So the basic assumption behind this framework is that whenever I have a circuit with no external wires, like this, so there's nothing coming in here, nothing going out on the other side, this represents a probability. What is this probability? This probability is of the joint occurrence of all these non-deterministic processes in the circuit. So in this case, it's a probability of preparing rho I, because even the preparation of a system can be non-deterministic, and then obtaining AJ and BM independently, and so on. The important thing to note here is that I'm not assuming any sort of causal structure in this setting by means that actually, for example, AJ and BM come somehow causally after rho I. So the only causal relation between this is the input and output relation, because there are theories where essentially the causal structure is not mirrored by the input-output relationship. So I can't say that this is, I don't know, the probability of having, for example, AJ and BM given that the state is rho I, because I can't really separate this is first, this is after. So, yes?
You say there's no assumption on causality. Does it mean you allow cycles? You allow things to feed back into the...
There are not cycles in the sense that actually the diagram won't contain cycle.
Will not.
Yet, the canonical example of...
That is a kind of causal restriction. It sounds like...
There is a causal restriction in the sense there is the input-output ordering. So basically, an output can only influence the input of something that comes after in the circuit. So if there's some sort of directed path, there's some sort of causal... I prefer calling it input-output ordering. The reason why is the following. I can make this example. So suppose I am considering a theory where my states are quantum channels instead of quantum states. Because a state is just a generic act of preparation of a system, a theory, and I can take whatever I want as that. In that case, let's call it C, and then I have, let's call it S, like this calligraphic S here. So this is, for example, the application of this into this case. So here, looking at this diagram, I would say that this actually comes causally after this one. But now, if we write this diagram, which is written in this kind of high-level theory, now we do write it in the ordinary quantum quantum language, then this is represented like this. So C is now, so this is in higher level theory, and this is instead in a quantum theory. So this is a channel, so I represent it like this. Now this S is something that can be shown to be representable like this. So that's so now you see that actually S breaks down into two parts. One that comes after the channel, one that comes before it. So in quantum theory, we know that there's a clear causal ordering between left and right. So that's kind of the causal. But in this case, it's not clear whether, if I look at here, I have only this kind of input-output relationship, but not a clear direct, clear causal relation between the two, because actually this S breaks down in this way here. This is called the theory of quantum supermaps. That's
so when you so you have two diagrammatic framework. One you call higher level. And you're showing us here higher level.
Yes, exactly.
But when you translate, but every higher level one translates into a.
No, in general, not. That's why I mean, in this case, because it's constructed out of quantum theory. In this case, the theory of quantum supermaps is constructed out of the theory of quantum theory. In this case, I'm not assuming any existence of a lower level theory here. I'm just writing down like this. So since I don't know what's going on, I'm very, let's say,
suppose we have the case where it is constructed out of quantum theory.
Yeah, yes.
And then you translate this higher level circuit into the lower level.
Yes, yes.
Will you sometimes have loops or cycles in lower levels?
No.
So it seems like you have two different causality relations that may not be quite equivalent to each other. But we could just rename this as the causal order.
Yeah. If you want, we can say this. Yeah. In any case, we won't find any loop. I mean, the only kind of loop-like thing is that actually this splits. But
this what?
This S here
splits
into two parts, let's say. So it's not actually in that direction, so it's some sort of backflowing, but it's in a very loose sense, if you want. Anyway, don't worry about this, because in the next slide, I'm going to assume causality in the standard sense. But anyway, just for the sake of completeness, I wanted to illustrate this. Anyway, just before going straight into causality, let me say something about what we mean by pure things. So the fact that, as we saw in this slide, we have probabilities, and probabilities are, I can establish some sort of real valued functions, and with, of course, those functions can be summed, so I can and take scalar multiples, so I can obtain real vector spaces. They're not just vector spaces, they're also ordered, because I can also take a cone inside that. And in this case, we can define the concept of coarse graining as some sort of in a very kind of operational way. So the idea, I mean, the classical idea of coarse graining is that, for example, if you have if you roll a die, then we have atomic events, like 1, 2, 3, so on, all of those. Then we also have like more coarse grained one. For example, the outcome is odd, and then it means just joining together different outcomes. And this is represented by the sum. So the sum actually implements this idea of coarse graining. Therefore, we say that transformation is pure if it can't be written as a non-trivial sum, which means a non-trivial coarse graining of other transformations. in more geometric pictures if a transformation is pure or if it's an extreme element of the cone where it belongs to. And there we go, that's we have causality in the standard sense. So the idea is that, in causal theories, we don't have any sort of information flowing back from the future. And basically, we can define it in loose terms in this way. So the probability that a transformation occurs doesn't depend on what I will choose later in the circuit. By later, I mean output, in that sense. So an important consequence of causality is that we have no signaling for systems between spatially separate systems. And this is something I'm going to use a lot in this talk, is the existence of so-called classical control. The idea is that I can, since information has a clear direction in which it flows, I can always perform a test according to the outcome of something that occurred previously. Previously in the sense of the circuit, because previously in the sense of the circuit also means previously in some sort of causal or temporal ordering, let's say. And in particular, this ability guarantees us to have the so-called measure and prepare tests. So something is a test, I say it's measure and prepare, if essentially I prepare a state conditioned on the outcome of a previous measurement. So this is the measurement I perform, this destroys the system, I get outcome I, and according to that I decide to prepare a specific state, rho I. And these ones, I can take them to be somehow normalized. Right, that's, let's say, the framework assumption. So now we can actually start going into the talk, which is roughly divided into two parts. The first part talks about decoherence, the first kind of properties we studied about decoherence, and then the second part is with the objectivity, and a bit of like a sort of some thoughts about local aspects in classical theory, which surprising, even apparently the emergence of classical theory has some non-locality issue even, but they're very specific kind of non-locality, definitely not the one we are used to thinking. Okay, so that's what I mean by it. I want to summarize first what I mean by classical theory. So in this case, classical theory, since I'm working everything with everything in finite dimension, classical theory is nothing but the theory of probability distributions over a classical set. So over a finite set, that's what I want to say. Geometrically, such a theory has a state space which is represented by a simplex. So here I chose the first three simplices, or the segment, the triangle, and the tetrahedron. And effects would be all of them, but the important thing is that the pure states, which are the vertices of the simplex, because remember that pure states are extreme, are jointly perfectly distinguishable. It means that there exists a measurement that is able to tell me with certainty which state it was prepared. So if I don't know which state I have between the pure classical states, I can always perform a measurement that tells me which state it is. And this is another important thing to note, that actually, of course, we need also to specify the cone of effects. And by doing this, we take the cone of states and we take its dual, so the cone of non-negative linear functional on the cone of states. And these are all, let's say, the effects all the classical effects generate the dual cone. That's the idea.
Confusion about the rooms.
Anyway, so the important thing is that why do we care about classical theory in the first place? Well, because as I presented at the very beginning, classical systems are presented implicitly as the outcomes of experiments. So they're all classical outcomes. So we want to make that the presence of outcomes explicit by essentially considering a decoherence process somehow. That would be the idea. And we want to understand how those classical outcomes can emerge out of a theory. Of course, this is a very ambitious project, and I can't say we solved this question, but at least we started going into a certain direction. Yeah, and actually, must say that this idea about distinction between explicit and implicit was, influenced by the workshop I attended last year here, actually, in the workshop on observers in quantum theory about the making observers explicit and so on. Now that's some of these ideas that basically floated there. Okay, so how do we look for classical theories? What we do is that we want to identify, first of all, set of distinguishable states, pure, perfectly distinguishable. The idea, I want to look for maximum states because I want to be able to distinguish them in a single shot and the maximum number of them, let's say. Because just to explain the difference, in quantum theory we have, so every orthogonal pure state are perfectly distinguishable, but they are, in general, they are not a maximal set because a maximal set is given by an orthonormal basis. It means that I can't add further states while keeping them all distinguishable. The question is, can we always find classical subtheories, which means perfectly distinguishable pure states in as a subset, as a subtheory of a given theory? The answer, surprisingly, is no. And we provided a counterexample of a theory that doesn't allow any sort of classical behavior in it. The curious thing about this theory is that actually if you want to construct this counterexample, you have to start right from classical theory. There might be others, but actually the one, this is what we found. So we start from the classical treat. So the classical system with three distinguishable states. Now I consider the cone of effects, which in the case of classical theory is the dual cone. But instead of allowing all effects in the dual cone, which will be the, this is just a slice of the cone, like a section, instead of allowing all the effects in the dual cone, which will be in the orange set, I'm just focusing on a subset of them, which is this blue set one. So this, what I get is some sort of restriction on the effects. So what happens is that if I reduce the number of effects, I need to check whether I also, some states get tomographically indistinguishable, because if I have fewer effects, then I am not able to witness the difference between states. But these effects here span the same vector space, this smaller cone. So actually, there's nothing strange happening in the original set of states. So the state space of this theory still looks like completely classical. Yet, the theory is not classical at all, because the pure states at the vertices are no longer perfectly distinguishable. And if we take also the composites of this by composing several of these objects here, there's no way of restoring the distinguishability of states, not even by taking composites of arbitrary large dimension. So somehow this theory doesn't admit classical limit at all, although generated by the classical theory, yes.
Why do you make the distinction between pure states and non-pure states? Like, why could you have a maximal set of mixed states?
Yeah, good question, because if I have a maximum set of pure distinguishable mixed states, then also I can decompose each of those into pure states, and the pure states into would be jointly distinguishable. So all in all, everything boils down to the distinguishability of pure states.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it. So if mixed states are this perfectly distinguishable, then also something that inside those, like in a convex decomposition, will be also perfectly distinguishable from everything that's on the other one. So.
Okay. Yeah. Actually, I have one more question.
Yeah.
It seems like in this case you could have perfectly excludable states. Like if you're given the midpoints on the triangles, mm-hmm. not a mixed, I guess, you could always tell what state it's not. Like if it's on this one face, the one dimensional face like this,
mm-hmm.
you could say it's not the state. Or if it's on that face, you could say it's not that state. I was just wondering if excludability is not interesting in classical theory. Like, why is discrimination more important than exclusion?
Well, because I think exclusion is like a very, it's a weaker notion, I think, than that. Because, I mean, if there are two, of course, then they are equivalent. But if there are more than two, then the situation becomes
yes.
more complicated. In this case, actually, something I would like to stress also is that here we lose the joint distinguishability of the three states, but we also lose the distinguishability between pairs of them. So I can't distinguish alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, but also I can't distinguish between alpha 1 and alpha 2 or alpha 1 and alpha 3 in terms of perfect distinguishing them, right? So it's a very strange theory. Essentially, that's the restriction is the key to creating this. And this is not entirely surprising, because actually there is a, I think, a result where they say that in fact every non-classical theory can be simulated, maybe not efficiently, but by taking a sufficiently large classical theory where you just introduce a sort of restriction. So that, therefore, this is essentially more or less what we're doing. We are simulating a non-classical theory by using a restricted classical theory somehow.
Yes. I noticed you didn't say what people often say, that if you find this particular pure state and then repeat the measurement, you get the same
result.
Is that an extra thing, or is it
No, that's a good question. We are going to say something about this later. Because in this case, my measurements are demolition, what I'm considering here. So I just give a probability, and they don't tell me anything else. They don't tell me what the state is. Good. So let's say that, the lesson from this is that there are some theories with non-trivial behavior. And also, the interesting thing is that sometimes looking just at the shape of the state space is not enough to characterize what the theory is. Because in this case, this looks entirely classical, but it's not. Okay, so from now on, I will assume that the theory has some set of perfectly distinguishable states to rule out these kind of strange pathological cases. Okay, then what I do is that I say that a classical set is nothing but the convex hull of the pure state, perfectly distinguishable pure states. With this, I just generate a simplex. We saw that this is not enough, because it's not enough to characterize the state space, because the state space can be a simplex, but the theory may not be classical. Therefore, what we do is also we need to identify what effects are to see if there are restrictions or not. So what we do is that we basically take the original effects of the theory, which are a lot of them, and then just assess their behavior on the classical set alpha. And then we take equivalence classes of indistinguishable effects, in the sense that I say that two effects of the original theory are indistinguishable on alpha if they give me the same probabilities for all classical states in alpha. This is an equivalence relation we can say, and we can immediately check. And basically, we can take the quotient set of the effects with respect to this equivalence relation. And it turns out that actually the quotient set is in fact a simplex itself. So there is no restriction like in the previous case. So there's nothing weird going on. So this is truly classical. And this simplex, simplicial cone to be precise, because of course in this case it will be impossible the cone of effects, is generated by the effects that distinguish the alpha eyes. Remember that the alpha eyes were distinguishable, so there were effects that distinguished them. Therefore, I could consider a cone, and therefore these effects, according to this result, span the cone of this span the quotient set. So this is really also surprising that actually constraining in this case the states and then taking this equivalent relation, you get everything classical, even in terms of effects. Okay, so this is a very sort of static approach in the sense that it's just like restrictions, finding sub-theory and so on. The next step is to go into a slightly more dynamical situation, although it's not, I agree, it's not fully dynamical, because we can still do much more and much better than this, but still something. We want to find a process that essentially behaves like a decoherence, mapping everything to classical states. First of all, What should this process be? Well, first of all, it shouldn't be probabilistic, because we observe that classical theory emerges in a stable way. So not just sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. So what we need to look for is something we call a channel, so something deterministic that always occurs with probability one. So
I don't quite understand it. Couldn't it be that historically it was some amplitude that the classical world emerged in, some amplitude that it did not? I mean, if you think of cosmology, for example.
Yes, I see the point. But let's say that in our case, maybe we are considering some sort of more like a everyday life experience where somehow we ordinarily observe classical physics. So yeah, this could also be an approximation, because we may say that actually classical physics arises with a very high probability, and sometimes it doesn't with a very small one. That's why we never really observe, but in principle, yeah, maybe, yes. Okay, we agree that maybe this can be a simplification to assume that actually this map is actually deterministic, so it always occurs with probability one.
So you have in mind something like a measurement that's producing classical?
That's kind of the idea, yes. We'll see that actually this is also true in general for all theories that have that. But now, just the definition is, okay, this is something, a channel, and then the channel should do nothing to classical states because they're already classical, those has nothing to do to them. And so the idea is that, so we take a channel, the alpha, which is a complete decoherence, onto this classical set alpha, if it leaves classical states invariant, fine, and it maps everything else to a classical state. This is the minimal desiderata. There are virtually no properties out of this. From a resource theoretic perspective, this is something called a resource destroying map, because somehow it kills viewing non-classical states as some sort of resources, then it kills them. So what are the properties of this map? It's idempotent on single system. So if I apply it twice on a state of a single system, it's like applying it once. But this doesn't mean that the theory that this map is idempotent, because if we don't have local tomography is the ability to distinguish, to tomographically distinguish states using product effects, distinguishing in the sense of not perfectly distinguishing, but in the sense of doing tomography with pure product effects, then if this condition doesn't hold, like in quantum theory with real Hilbert space, then this condition here is weaker than that. So this is, it's idempotent only when applied to a single system. And an interesting thing is that if we take the set of decohered effects, so I take the original effect of the theory, I apply the decoherence, so I just take their composition. Well, yes?
Sorry, but I just didn't understand what you just said. I mean, on the first line it says d alpha squared rho is equal to d alpha rho for
yes.
every rho.
Yes.
That normally, that's just the definition of d alpha squared equals d alpha.
If the theory is locally tomographic.
I mean, that's just in mathematics, that's just the definition.
Yes, true, but the problem...
something is hidden and I didn't understand.
The problem is that... in the real... So this is ordinarily what we have. So basically this specifies the action completely of a map, right? So this is like writing the row. But in general, what one should do is consider the action on, since one wants to build circuits which represent the most general experiment, then one should consider the action on bipartite states when they apply only to half of it. This is also similar to what we consider complete positivity. And essentially, to be precise, this is how we define the action of a map. So basically, in this case, it's like D tensor the identity applied to rho AB. Now, if we can distinguish states using product effects, I can apply an effect here, and an effect here. And then basically this one, if I apply an effect here, this will induce a state on this other side here. And this basically tells me if from the action of on a bipartite system, I can recover the action on the single system. But now suppose that instead I can only act with product one. So with a bipartite one, which doesn't factorize. Then I can't use this argument to infer the action here. So the action here is specified by this. If you want, alternative explanation about this is that actually, in this way, for quantum theory, every state can be written as a linear combination of product states. But for real quantum theory, instead of having complex numbers, have real numbers, this is not true. So it's not true that every state can be written as a linear combination of product ones. So to have like an idea of what happens is that take the Pauli Y.
I understand that. That's the failure of local tomography
exactly.
for real quantum mechanics.
Exactly. So the idea is that there might be some maps that have the same action on the level of single system, But the action suddenly becomes different when you increase and take a bipartite system.
So could you show an example where d squared is not equal to d using this setup? I mean, it's just by drawing this diagram.
Oh, in fact, let's say that's not obvious to find an example. We didn't find, let's say, examples of that. But in principle, they might be, let's say, that's the same. So we should be like the.
What would it mean if it happened in principle? Would it mean that if you put in two copies of?
So what it might be is that what it might mean is that actually, if you do this, then this is equal. I'm sorry, you don't see.
Yeah, it's equal to. I see it for other people.
Yeah. So this is equal to. This is what I wrote there. This is true at the level of sigma, but it might be that when I take like a big sigma here, if I apply it twice,
it's not the same.
It's not the same. That's it. So going back here, we have that the set of decohered effects. So basically applying the decoherence to effects rather than to states is actually coincides with the quotient set modulo that equivalence relation of tomographic indistinguishability of effects. So the decoherence is compatible with the way we identify classical effects. Although with this very general decoherence, we have a kind of asymmetric behavior between states and effects because the decoherence fixes classical states by definition, but in general, it doesn't fix the corresponding effect. So the effect AI is the effect that gives you one on alpha I. So AI decohered through D alpha, in general, won't be equal to AI, but will be equivalent, tomographically equivalent on the classical set. So that's the kind of non-trivial and part of it. So we can't say more than this. Yes.
Is there always an effect in the equivalence class that is left invariant by the decoherence map?
We don't know either. Because the problem is that since the decoherence is defined only on states, with this general definition, you can't infer anything unless you assume some properties of the theory, but in principle you don't. Okay. So another problem is, okay, now there are the classical problems, are existence and uniqueness of the decoherence. Does it exist for every classical set alpha, and is it unique? So I start with uniqueness, which is slightly easier. So if I fix alpha, is it possible that I find more than one decoherence onto alpha? Again, in principle, yes, although we didn't find any concrete counterexamples in this respect. So what does it mean? It can be unique, it can be non-unique in two ways. In the first way is that it's non-unique because the same state is decohered to two different classical states by the two different decoherence maps. That's the most obvious way of non-uniqueness. So apply these two rows, and the one gives you one state, the other one gives another one. And the second case is more subtle and is again related to this problem about local tomography, is that they might be unique at the level of single system, in the sense that actually all states are decohered to the the two maps are decohere the state in the same way when applied to a single system. But then, if I find a bipartite system, I can find a bipartite system, maybe, and their two are different. So if I decohere only half of a bipartite state, then I can witness the difference between these two decoherences. But if I just apply them to the states of a single system, I can't see any difference between the two. Again, if the theory satisfies local tomography, this is not the case because when two maps are the same on single system, they're also the same in that case. Okay, what about the existence of a decoherence? Does it exist? At least one for every classical set? The answer is yes. How do we construct it? So we can consider the measure and prepare test. So alpha I's are the classical states. A I's are the effects that distinguish between these classical states. This test is allowed by causality because it's a classically controlled test, as I showed at the very beginning. And now what we do is that we take the full coarse graining over that, so we sum over all possible outcomes, and then we get the what we call the measurement-induced decoherence, which is we can prove that actually satisfies the two properties of the definition of measure of decoherence. And this has nice properties because it's really idempotent in this case, and it also leaves the classical effects invariant, unlike the general case, which may not leave those invariant. So in this case, we restore the symmetry between states and effect, which is something that we like, and therefore I think it's more physically motivated than the general definition we want to consider. So there's an interesting thing to note, that actually John here did two amazing works about the theory of decoherence. And so essentially one of the requirements there was that actually the decoherence wasn't purity increasing, because that's what we observe in the quantum case. So everything, and people often use this argument to explain why we have classical theory, because they say, and we observe mixed states, is that because the decoherence essentially kills, makes everything mixed. But actually decoherence should be said to, we should be more precise and say that actually decoherence makes everything incoherent to be really correct. And here there is an example in which there is a striking difference between these two concepts. So according to the natural definition of decoherence, decoherence can only send mixed states to mixed states. It can't increase the purity of a state. But we found a counterexample where instead it does increase the purity of a state. And this is the case of the square bit of this square here. So in this case, let me maybe try to use this. Okay, so this is the state space. So every pair of, so the pure states are the vertices. Every pair of vertices are perfectly distinguishable. And then the, every each of them is a maximal set. Now focus on this one, on this left side of the square. So this black segment here, I don't know how well you can see, but anyway, this is a black segment here, which represents a classical set alpha. Now, if you calculate the measurement-induced decoherence using that formula, using the distinguishing effect and so on, you see that essentially, if you have a state row here, that basically maps everything to that, that segment and like projects it horizontally in this way. Now, apply this to a mixed state here, in the upper face, and this one gets projected onto alpha 1, which is pure. In general, you can observe this behavior anytime when the effect that, that gives probability 1 on a classical state also gives probability 1 on another pure state, like in this case, because the effect that gives 1 on alpha 1 picks all this phase here. So it also gives 1 on alpha 4. Therefore, anytime I have mixed state, which is a mixture of two of these two states, then this will get decohered to a pure state. So somehow it's a feature of a theory that had like straight lines in their boundary somehow. So that's an interesting example that shows that there is a clear difference, better than in quantum theory, between the notion of purity and coherence. So really, decoherence should be used to explain the lack of coherence, and rather than the origin of mixedness, let's say. Okay, so this is as far as the origin of classicality is concerned. Now let's turn to the objectivity. So what do we mean by objective states? This definition was given in a paper by Olivier and Zurek. We say that a state is objective if many observers can determine it without disturbance, agreeing on their findings. So originally this definition was given exactly like this in words, no formulas provided. So there was a contribution by Richard Horodetsky, Jarek Korbich, and Pavel Horodetsky about how to make this statement precise. And I will talk about this later, because essentially what we are doing then is just translating that definition to the case of GPTs, and we'll find essentially that the structure is very similar. So anyway, so in that work, they also managed to characterize what objective states are in this meaning here. Then we can discuss about this when, as soon as I present the setting. Basically, in the quantum case, there are some multipartite states. So the system is decohere in a basis here. And then we have a tensor product here. So it's like a classical state, because for each system, EI, E1 from EN, these states are perfectly distinguishable. So it's really, so it's a specific form of states. So these states here for every system, you see they have orthogonal support. These states are called SBS. SBS stands for spectrum broadcast structure, because it was used to, in quantum Darwin, to say sort of broadcasting information. Anyway, let's try to understand what this means and how this was obtained. So what we do is the following. So we have a setting of a quantum Darwin. In quantum Darwin, there is a central observer surrounded by multiple environments. And the idea here, we are assuming that every environment is accessible by one observer. And there is also a privileged one observer acting as a sort of referee in the middle here, so in the system S. And the referee in S checks the findings of the other players or observers. So we can essentially formulate it as a multiplayer game. So the first move is by the referee itself, who essentially measures on some classical set alpha, doing a measure and prepare test, as we saw earlier. So basically what it creates decoherence. It's the source of decoherence in S. The idea is that we have multiple players, and each of them plays according to some rules, and we'll see the rules later on. And their goal is to find the state of S by using their joint correlation, because essentially this system, they all share like a joint state, and they can only access their own environment here by applying performing some measure, and they want to infer some information about S. That's the idea. And they want to determine S without disturbing the overall state. What's the definition of non-disturbing? So this definition is sometimes, they called it the Bohr non-disturbance condition, which was generalized in the case of GPTs. Also, independently by Paolo Perinotti, we discovered that he did like definition on non-disturbance in GPT several years ago, before we, of course, we started even looking at this. In general, we say that a state A is non-disturbing on rho. Sorry, not a state. A test A is AI is non-disturbing on rho. If when I apply it on rho and I coarse grain over all possible outcomes. So I just coarse graining over all possible states after the test, I get back a row. They argue that actually this is what Bohr meant when he formulated his non-disturbance criterion, based on a paper by Howard Wiseman. Although it's not so clear, but we can just take it that as a definition of non-disturbance. And what the players are constrained is to use some sort of repeatable measurement that can be repeated several times. So here we have something, they give the definition of sharply repeatable tests. So sharply repeatable tests are a test for which we have this condition here. This should look familiar because it's essentially the same condition we have for Neumann measurements. And these four Neumann measurements are examples of these sharply repeatable tests. So in quantum theory, these things are for Neumann measure, as I said, but there are also other things that are not for Neumann measurement. For example, take some states sigma j's that have orthogonal support. Take pj's to be the projector on their support. And now take a quantum instrument whose elements are essentially given by this. So it's like a measure and prepare thing. I'm measuring, projecting every state row onto the support of the sigma j's, and then applying the preparing the corresponding sigma j. So these are measured and prepared. Instead, in general, phonemic measures are not. They are measured and prepared only if the projectors are of rank one. But in the other case, they are not, because they preserve the coherence in the subspace where they project. Now, the question is, do these things exist in any general theory or not? The answer is yes, because at least we always have the measure and prepare type. So if rho i's are perfectly distinguishable, and they are distinguished by these effects ei, then I can construct this measure and prepare test, because I'm measuring this and preparing the state, the corresponding state rho I, if I obtain ei. And this is a measure and prepare, and it can prove that it satisfies this condition here. So this condition is important because sometimes the fact that we can repeat something and without disturbing it means that somehow we obtain objective information. That was somehow the idea behind the EPR argument and so on. Therefore, the important message is that actually these sharply repeatable tests exist in all causal theories. Therefore, we can run the same argument that was originally done for quantum theory using phonemic measurement, using this new kind of stuff, which are more general than phonemic measurement, but still exists in every causal theory, because in general, we can't prove that the analog of phonemic measurement exists, which are pure and satisfy these things. So in general, that's not obvious. So the other conditions that we have is that the players can't cooperate, so they can't have like some sort of joint measurement. So they can only measure their own part. And then finally, we have this strong independence condition. So basically, expressed in words is the following: the only correlation between the players is the common information about the system. So in other words, their only correlation can only be through the outcome of the measurement, nothing more than that. And that's it. That's kind of enforcing the, yes? Previous slide?
Yeah. I missed the last argument here. Had you argued previously that in all causal theories there exist sets of perfectly distinguishable?
No, they say that from that point on, if they exist, because now we are assuming they exist, we are ruling out this pathological case like the restricted treat. So now
in all causal theories for which these do exist.
Exactly. That's the idea. So if essentially we can't even have the decoherence of to start with, if there are no classical states. So,
okay. Do you need the causal assumption?
Yes, because otherwise we don't know whether this is a valid test or not, because it's classically controlled. So essentially, there's classical information that flows from this measurement here, from the EI to this. So basically, if I obtain outcome I prepare the state rho I. That's how it works. So, going back here, eventually we can repeat the same argument exactly as it follows, provided we replace some of the assumption with these kind of more operational ones. And we find that in every causal theory with classical states, that's an assumption, all objective states are of this form. So this is a necessary and sufficient condition for objective states. And the only, thing that guarantees the existence of this is causality. So we are not assuming anything. Originally, we thought that actually we would need a theory very close to quantum theory with a lot of structure in it. But in fact, it turns out that we don't need it. So it's very general result, just based on causality and nothing else. So this, of course, raises a lot of questions. But first, let me... Yes?
So these rho i's, they're not necessarily all the same state. They can be any for each.
Yeah, exactly. They are the same. They're not the same. For different systems, they can be different.
And they're not necessarily pure.
No, exactly. They can be whatever. So the quantum result is this. So basically, it tells us that if you want to constrain. So constraining a theory based on objectivity is probably not a good idea, if you want to, some sort of, because apparently everything that allows classical states also allows for objective behavior, so we don't really get any interesting result out of this. I mean, this is per se interesting, but it's not like something that basically restricts us a lot, yes?
But it seems to me that you get the interesting thing precisely because you're restricting attention to the theories which have perfectly distinguishable states. Like, that's what's giving you always...
Yeah, but the fact that they have the same structure as in the quantum case is not obvious.
I agree, but I feel like your restriction to theories which have perfectly distinguishable states is kind of, in some sense, critical. Like, it surprises me that you don't put that in as a kind of precondition in the theorem. Like, in every causal theory which has perfectly distinguishable sets of states, alpha and rho, blah, blah, blah. Like, why do you view that as like a background assumption that's so unimportant to state that you don't really...
No. It's not actually that I think it's not unimportant. I just omitted it for reason of space, because otherwise it wouldn't fit there. But as I said, after the example of the restricted trait, which is very pathological, because it has this kind of artificial restriction, if we want, then for the rest of the talk, I would always assume that actually these states are the perfect distinguishable states exist.
Okay. In what sense is it pathological? It seems like most GPTs are kind of restrictions like that, like in the space of all GPTs, most of them will have.
The problem is that, I mean, except for that specific case, I don't know of any other GPTs that doesn't allow for perfectly distinguishable states. I mean, there might be some strange thing. The problem is that, as always with GPTs, we lack concrete examples about this.
If we're not doing quantum theory, what is that tensor product?
Means just the composition of systems in a very abstract sense, very loose sense. In a more mathematical sense, it's like
the theory should have this notion of part of the definition of the theory that it must have this.
Yeah, exactly. Where this in general is not like really a tensor product in the sense of vector tensor product, just a notation to mean composition of systems.
But when you started in the beginning, you gave the general framework, general probabilistic theory.
Yes.
Is it part of that framework that the
Yes, exactly. Yes.
And this part of David's question, but it sounded like you were asking about how generic in space of all GPTs it is to no perfectly distinguishable states.
Yes.
If you're not assuming the no restriction hypothesis, then it seems to me the case of being unable to perfectly distinguish is the generic case. Because I can take any GPT where things are perfectly distinguishable, and then make it a bit more mixed. All the states come in a little bit. That's another perfectly good GPT, but now things are not perfectly distinguishable. So if we had a measure over the space of GPTs, I would say that the cases where things are perfectly distinguishable are measure zero. That's not a rigorous argument, but just intuitively it seems that way to me.
Well, I see the point, but the thing is that somehow the crucial thing is that this lack of... So the problem about the restriction, for example, why imposing that, is that we needed that restriction to be also stable under the composition of systems. In the sense that actually, it might be that actually, for a single system, we don't have perfectly distinguishable states, but when we put combine systems together, then somehow the restriction doesn't work as well as in the previous system, in the previous case. And then we can somehow be able to activate some sort of distinguishability criterion. I mean, that maybe composing more than sometimes that pops out some sort of this. These are things that need to be checked, let's say, in general. Yeah, I agree that imposing restriction is always a subtle thing, because you have to do it in a way that also you don't affect the state space somehow. I mean, in this case, we wanted to not affect the state space to show that even classical theory is somehow can be pathological in the sense that that even if the state space looks classical, in fact, the theory doesn't really look classical somehow in its behavior. And then, what else did I want to say? Yeah, I mean, clearly, restricting creates a lot of troubles, let's say, to the let's say we need to check things, because you can also lose the tomographic distinguishability, and of course it also impacts the distinguishability of states. Now, what did I want to say more about this? Oh yes, that's in general the problem is how do we justify that restriction, I think. Because in that case, it was very artificial, if you want. You can always say that some, maybe some sort of noise that doesn't allow you to pick the most fine-grained examples, but there might be, of course, a justification around that.
So you appeal to the question of, like, if I have multiple copies,
mm-hmm.
things could become suitable.
Yeah.
It seems to me that that's generically going to be true. So if I have...
In this case, it's not. No.
So what I was imagining is, you know, if I have two states that are not perfectly distinguishable,
mm-hmm.
but let's say there's a measurement that, you know, with 90% probability can distinguish them. Now, if I just do n copies, you know, so I prepare the first state n times or the second state n times, and I don't even do a joint measurement, I just do the
yeah.
measurement on each of them.
Yes.
Then I get more and more confident about which of the two states was prepared. And so in the limit that n becomes large, I can get the probability of discriminating as close as I want to one. So that feels like a generic property, you know, regardless of what state effect space you started with.
So there's something that's a very good point here in the sense that actually what I said about the lack of distinguishability, it's actually in the sense that in that example I provided, it's not in the let's say I didn't examine this in the limit. So what I the complete statement would be to study the distance, let's say, between states that are not perfectly distinguishable and states that become perfectly distinguishable to see that that distance becomes smaller and smaller. So in fact, that something that wasn't distinguishable approaches something that becomes distinguishable in some sort of limit. The problem is that the way we proved it, essentially, for every n, for n large as you want, essentially, then you can't find any pure states that are perfectly distinguishable. By n means like the number of treats I'm composing here. So they're still not perfectly distinguishable. The problem is that they may approach something that becomes perfectly distinguishable in the limit, let's say. But we studied for finite, let's say, n, for however large, but still not, let's say, we didn't study how this approaches the case where they become distinguishable. So the restriction may, and the way the system composes makes it particularly involved to study how things work, but in general, the thing is that you can't, yeah, because you can't really have something that gives you zero in any case, because for the restriction, you would need to get something that is outside the cone, essentially. So you can't really approach, but you can't really get perfect zero. But yeah, probably I think by applying this kind of argument, because product measurements are always available, let's say, so you can somehow repeat it several times.
So. I'm not exactly sure what your philosophy is, but if you did allow for objective states, or maybe approximately objective states.
Oh, that's also another question we didn't investigate. So it's also how we can relax some of the things.
If you did allow that, then it seems to me you'd have the potential to say essentially all GPTs have such a notion. Whereas I feel like if you demand this ideal of perfect discrimination, and I would say it's more like almost no GPTs have this, because in my reckoning, almost none of the GPTs in the space of all GPTs have perfectly distinguishable states. So if you want genericness of objectivity, it seems like that's a good motivation to go for an approximate notion.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think if you stick with this ideal notion, it's hard to make the case that this is a generic property.
I see. Yeah, I think that's an interesting point indeed. Good. So I don't know how we are with time. I have
a little bit of time left.
Okay.
Maybe another 5 minutes?
Yes, yeah, I can definitely finish. Just a few slides about the last part, which is about the locality somehow. So in the objectivity game, we had several systems that surrounded somehow the target system, so somehow we had this kind of local observer acting. So the natural question in this setting is, okay, what about the emergence of local classical theory at all? So when it's possible to have like classical observers. So ideally, suppose we have a bipartite system AB, and we know that alpha is a classical set for A, and beta is a classical set for B. So is it true? How do we construct that classical set for the composite? Can we do this? Well, ideally, this is what we want. If the theory has is local in the sense of the classical behavior, so it doesn't have some sort of holistic property we'll examine later, the classical set for the composite system can be written as the minimal tensor product of the two classical sets. That's essentially, this tells me that the classical set for AB, I can write a classical set for AB as the composition, the classical composition of two classical sets. So eventually, these alpha and beta are really classical theories, even in the ways they compose. And in this case, if this is also one of the requirements, is that the coherence on the composite can be factorized as the parallel composition of the decoherence in the components. And this was also one of the requirements that John and his collaborators put in one of their paper. But again, these are actually not so trivial requirements. So what do we need? So in order to rule out some sort of weird behavior, we need two axioms. So the first is that the product of two pure states should be pure, because in general, it may not be pure. We know that there is the example of quaternionic quantum theory. Now there is also another new example. It was developed by the people in Pavia. They call the coherent classical theory, where essentially the composition of pure states is not pure. They presented this year at QPL. So that's actually an interesting point. And in addition to this, we also have that the product of pure maximal sets may not be maximal, in the sense that actually if I have a kind of classical thing that's maximal here and something that's maximal here, when I compose them, the thing can still lack some pieces. So I can still add some more perfectly discernible states to that. So to rule out this, we impose two axioms. The product of pure states is pure. And then actually the information locality introduced by Lucy and Harvey, and where the product of two pure maximal sets is still maximal. So we don't miss anything by composing two things together when they are pure and perfectly distinguishable. What is the pathological behavior? So if we take for example, two pure states for which the product is not pure, and we want to construct the classical set for AB, we have to look for completely different states because some of them suddenly becomes mixed. So now, definitely, this idea of reducing the classical behavior of the overall system to the behavior of the component basically fails. So we have sort of very extreme holism of the theory. On the other hand, if information locality fails, then still we can construct everything out of pure states, but we can't construct a full maximal set, but only a partial one, that's not a maximal one. So we need to look for some extra states to make it maximal. So it's definitely less holistic than in the previous case where we obtained mixed states, but still it's not fully, let's say, local in it. And in order to avoid these two strange holistic behaviors, then we introduce those two axioms. So in this case, once we introduce those axioms, we can also study the issue of the locality in the decoherence, whether we can say that the decoherence of the composite system is actually the tensor product of the decoherence in the components. But since our definition of decoherence is so general, given as in terms of a sort of resource-destroying map, we can say anything because we don't know how the decoherence acts on states. We only know that it maps them to classical ones, but we don't know what it really does to each of them. But however, if we focus on the measurement-induced decoherence, then we have that actually the tensor product of the two decoherences in a separate system also gives me the decoherence in the composite classical set. So this, of course, makes that this measurement-induced decoherence particularly appealing and the most physically motivated. Again, if the theory admits classical states, then this is the most physically motivated example of decoherence, the one that probably behaves best. So, to conclude. So again, not all classic physical theory allow classical sub-theories, and we showed a counterexample of a theory that looks classical, but in fact it isn't. For the others, for every classical sub-theory, we have a decoherence process, always, possibly even more than one, as we saw. And this process is, at least the privileged one, is induced by the act of measuring, and the existence of this map is guaranteed by causality. And objective states in those theories exist and have the form, the SBS form here. So now the question is, so since we recovered the basically the results of some of the results of a quantum Darwin is essentially only using causality and the existence of distinguishable states, perfectly distinguishable states, there's a question is what is quantum about quantum, the whole project about quantum Darwin is maybe just causality and some very mild assumptions can actually tell us something about the about how a classicality emerges. Maybe classical theory emerges like this because we need it in order to do physics. So all physical theories that are well behaved, let's say, allow for some sort of classicality in some emerging limit. Again, maybe it's just this Darwinism and this, the way classicality emerges and through decoherence and so on, it's just a general paradigm if you want to do physics in a fundamental way, at least. If you don't want to have some sort of like a cut between the level of operations and the level of the operation in the theory and the level of experimental data we have in we can extract from laboratory. So I think this is, in general, probably an interesting and fruitful future research area for both people who are interested in quantum Darwinism and people who are also interested in GPTs. And that's it. I'll leave you with some references. Thank you for your attention.
Slide where you introduced the game, the multiplayer game.
The first one?
Yeah. This one, yeah.
Yeah.
So here you have a privileged player,
mm-hmm.
And this person chooses some classical set alpha. Is that an important, like, is this related? I was wondering if this is related to the uniqueness of the decoherence map you talked about.
No, this is not related. We just need to know that a decoherence exists. We don't need to know whether this is unique or not. Let's say that if this referee applies the measurement-induced decoherence, which is the most physically motivated one, then we can also interpret, let's say, his or her move in a consistent way with the other ones. Because, for example, the distinguishing, the measurement that produces the decoherence is a sharply repeatable test. So if this is the alpha i's are distinguished by the AIs, then the decoherence arises at the measurement-induced decoherence, which I call like this, arises as a full coarse graining over this. Now, each of these things here, so if you take this, this is a sharply repeatable test. You can check because it's a measurement prepared, these are perfectly distinguishable, so it satisfies that condition there. So if the observer on S applies this measurement, essentially it works in a similar way to the other ones. But in principle, for the argument to work, this is not necessary. Just it's enough that that observer decoheres the system.
So I guess my follow-up question would be, how much is the game contingent on this preferred observer? Or is it just to illustrate something?
Oh, let's say that we need, what we need to do is that in order to, this is an assumption they also consider in the quantum case. So it's not just specific to the GPT case. It's something that's already present there. Let's say that for the proof of that result, it's essential that actually the preferred observer performs a measure and prepare thing. Let's say in that sense, such that it decoheres in this way, let's say. Yes?
It's a related question, I think. Can you just in words say what's going on with this game? I mean, So here is this preferred observer, he or she.
Exactly.
Does a projective measurement.
Whatever, yes, exactly.
And then what are the others?
The other ones.
How does it get information get broadcast into
Let's say that information, let's say specifically, we don't know what the map looks like, the map that broadcasts information from one side to the other. But the map in this case is implicit in the present. It's what is broadcast is the outcome, let's say, is this I here that's moved there. But it's done in an implicit way. There's no like a real process showing that. So that's partly, that's something we want to do, but next, let's say. So this is just, as I said, a preliminary result. Anyway, the idea is the following. So this guy acts first and performs this thing. The other ones, each of them performs one of those tests, which are sharply repeatable. And they repeat it because they want to find somehow the statistics. And what they do is that they are restricted to performing always the same, so they can't change. So they can't like do tomography. That's, otherwise, the thing becomes easier. So they have this fixed scenario. Then once you do this, so basically, now what you do, you have a state, a joint state, for which you know what happens here on the other level of system S, and you know that each of the players perform a sharply repeatable test. Now, what you do is that you want to impose the no disturbance criterion, because we want the joint state not to be disturbed. If you impose this condition, then you can derive that the only structure that's compatible with the no disturbance condition is this one.
I'm trying to understand, how does that state get created?
Yeah, so basically this part gets created by this decoherence operated by the observer on S.
Yeah.
Then the fact that these things are, for every environment fragment, these things are perfectly distinguishable is given by the fact that these guys are applying these sharply repeatable tests. This gives you the distinguishability of those.
Right, but is the first person just informing, just, you know, recording their results in various notebooks all over the place?
No.
And that's the environment? No, they're not doing
that. No, they're not doing that, no.
So how is the information getting into these notebooks or whatever these other photons or whatever these other environment systems are?
Basically, because there's a condition that arises from there that's derived even in the quantum case, that essentially in order for them to agree on something, that's the agreement part, then they have to get all the same outcome.
Right.
That's why there is the I.
I'm not asking how do you prove that this is the only form. I'm asking, in practice, how would this form get established? Why would a state row of this form come into being? That's really what I'm asking. You say you don't have to make too concrete of a model, but you must have some vague idea of how it's... I mean, suppose it's in quantum theory. How would it...
In quantum theory, basically, the information is broadcast in an implicit way through the agreement condition. So since...
But suppose I wanted to do this in a lab. I mean, I'm missing something.
Yes. No, the problem is that
there has to be some coupling between this first observer and the
yes.
environment.
Yes.
And you haven't really told us what it is.
No, essentially the coupling is given by the fact that I'm considering a joint state.
That's the outcome of this experiment, right? I mean, that's not...
Yes.
That's
but
what you have after it's all
true,
over,
true.
But
no, the thing is that, so I think we are... So what I mean is that actually each... so we want to identify what objective states are rather than actually the actual procedure in which to create them.
Right, and I'm asking about the second.
Yeah, the problem is that I know. That's something that we still have to do. But in general, it's you can actually have a broadcasting map, which you can prove that actually can be arbitrarily well approximated by a measure and prepare one. That was a paper by Brandau, Piani, or Desi, where they studied that. Where?
So there exists some sort of CP map that does.
Yeah, exactly. In quantum case, yes, we know. In this case, we don't know yet because we haven't studied it yet. Yes.
But the question is, can you kind of unpack
of course,
CP map and say what it's really doing? Or?
Oh, the CP map is actually...
I mean, what is it? If I try to build one...
Oh, it's actually kind of complicated in the sense I think that in the original paper, whose proof is extremely complicated, by the way, they show that actually the map is close to measure and prepare one. So they show that there is some stuff that actually... So there is some...
So could it be close to that story that I just said before? The first guy does the measurement, and then he or she copies the result into a bunch of notebooks.
Yeah, it could be something...
Scattered in different buildings and different...
Yeah, it could be something, yeah. It's,
or sends emails to all their friends and with the outcome.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is that these things can be actually realized through measurement, because I think in the original paper, they just studied the broadcasting between different observers, and then they proved that actually the only way that's consistent with objectivity is to have that broadcast, the broadcasting occurring through a measurement. So basically copying then the outcome of the measurement several times. Yeah.
So it's not entirely clear how this connects to the kind of decoherence that happens in the real world. So
yeah. I agree. We're still missing the dynamical part about how do we enact decoherence there. Because let's say the environment so far is present in an implicit way through this action of measurement and these classical outcomes here. In this case, I'm summing over them. So this somehow these classical outcomes live somewhere because they are kind of produced. So that's somehow the idea of how you generate that. But of course, yeah, there's still a lot of work to do. So we just scratched the surface of a kind of interesting area.
Okay, so we are running out of time, so let's thank Colin Rea again.